Welcome to Modern Digital Applications, a podcast for corporate decision makers and executives looking to create or extend their digital business with the help of modern applications, processes, and software strategy. Now, welcome your host, a recognized industry thought leader in cloud computing and published author, bringing over 30 years of experience, Lee Acheson.
My guest today is Kevin Gosler. Kevin is the Senior Vice President for Technology Strategy at Originate. Originate is a digital agency that helps organizations with digital transformation best practices. Kevin has a PhD in business computer science and is an avid software developer. He currently is the maintainer for GitTown, which is an open source project that provides a high-level CLI for Git. Previously, Kevin worked as a software developer at Google, which is where he was exposed to monorepos. Kevin is a Git expert and process advocate, and he's here to discuss with me the pros and cons of monorepos versus polyrepos. This is part two of my interview with Kevin. One of the things that's easier in monorepo is a consistent philosophy, a consistent set of standards implemented all at once atomically. That's true, but the cost of that is reduced independence of the development teams and reduced independence in the ownership model and the reduced ability for a team to own their own fate, which is, in the models I use, critical for maintaining availability and maintaining scalability. This is why they're both best practices, right?
Yeah. And I mean, look, there are some things that you want teams to have independence over. Like often teams understand best what their particular requirements are and what technology satisfies them best. You don't want to lock them into what the central architecture team has decided. But there are other things that are not up to the teams. Like compliance is not up to each team or security, right? So
again, those things though are handled through TPMs in the polyrepo organization style. Mm-hmm. There's someone whose job it is to go through and make sure compliance across the organization.
And in my opinion, a monorepo makes the job of these people much easier. Like the compliance team in a monorepo sees the entire code base. They can write automated tooling that can verify compliance. They can scan for vulnerable libraries very easily, especially if you share dependencies, which is something we can get to, where you have only a single version of dependencies across the company. Everybody uses the same version of a shared library, which saves you dependency hell, and which saves you from having to run artifact repositories internally and a whole set of other issues like versioning of libraries. You can update everybody at the same time. If somebody uses a vulnerable library, the security team can go in and update that library and make sure everybody gets updated and nobody gets broken.
Right. But I think it really does come down to a company culture philosophy here, because the philosophy that you're talking about is there is someone that goes in and does all that for you, which means you lose, as an owner of a service, you lose some control, but you also have fewer things you have to be responsible for because you just know those sorts of things are going to happen. In the polyrepo strategy, in the STOSA model, there is still that person that's responsible for going around and doing that, but they're not the ones doing it. They're the ones coordinating it. Each team owner then has a responsibility to make it done. And oh, by the way, it is part of their responsibility to make sure those things do get done. And if they're not, that's, you know, an organizational issue for the manager of that team if they're not doing these things, these critical changes when they come up. So when a security vulnerability comes up in the STOSA model, that needs to be communicated broadly to the organization. And individual team owners are responsible to do, with all due haste, it's required by whatever the level of the problem it is, make the change as necessary and as appropriate in their environment using their own concerns and circumstances to make sure that happens. They fail if they don't, they succeed if they do. And it's that simple, you know. But they're the ones responsible for making it happen. The person responsible globally to make sure it gets done, their job then is the coordinator to make sure they each team has the tools necessary to make it happen and to actually validate that it actually happens, but they don't do the work. They're the ones that make sure the work gets done. You know, it really truly is, how is ownership done? Is ownership at a hierarchy where there's higher order responsibility that flows down, or is ownership at the bottom that flows up? And that's, the bottom flows up is how the, you know, the Amazons of the world do it with the poly repos, and the top down is more how the mono repo structures make it happen.
And I think what I like, you can do the same thing in a mono repository. If the decision is made that in our company, we want this to be independent for each team, by all means, make it independent for each team in a mono repository. But a multi-repository locks you into that model. And a mono repository, in addition, allows you also to do larger changes. You can centralize certain functions. For example,
it allows you to do larger scale changes easier that it, I would argue, shouldn't be allowed to be easy. There are certain types of changes that are seen to be simple and easy that really need to be harder, and the poly repo structure makes them harder because the change has risk associated with it. Let's take an example. Let's say a procedure name needs to change from John J-O-H-N something to John J-O-N something. Trivial change, right? And that procedure is called from 150,000 places throughout the code base. Boy, in a mono repo structure, that change is simple. You do a global search and replace, single check-in, single commit, it's all done, no problem. Everything's taken care of. I argue that change was simple to make, but it introduced a significant amount of risk into the code base by making that change simply. Now, in a poly repo structure, that change is a lot harder to make because you have to change change APIs and across all the boundaries. You have to change it at the source and make a backward compatible version, and then make sure everybody updates it and make sure each team makes all the changes. And once all the changes are done, then you can take out the old version, and all that sort of stuff has to happen. It's a lot harder change. But guess what? There's no risk increase that goes on during that process. So the change itself was a lot harder to implement, but it should have been harder, because by making it easier, you make it easier by introducing risk. And increased risk means reduced availability. And it's that simple.
So I agree that certain things shouldn't be easy, especially violating correctness or violating security, right? I'm not sure that large-scale code repair or code maintenance falls into that. I agree with you that we want to ensure that certain quality checks are happening and certain collaboration is happening, and we don't violate certain principles like team independence. But it's hard to argue against making stuff easy, right? So the way this
I can argue against making things easy. I think actually that's one of the fundamental problems that some organizations run into, and why some organizations have availability problems, or for that matter, scaling problems, is they make certain things easy that shouldn't be easy.
Yeah. The way it would be, like the way Google does it, who have a very sophisticated mono repository setup, is they don't just make this change. They have a review committee that reviews that change. Again, it's this churn that I create and this change and this need for extra deployments. Is that worth the rename from John to John? If the answer is yes, they would reach out to each team and announce that, right? Or the teams would be part of this review committee. Or you have somebody who has an overview over the entire code base and can just make that call. Like, I don't need to ask each team, like, certain basic things.
See, that person who would make that change at a company like Amazon would be fired.
No, like...
Because you don't have anybody There is no role that of a person that has that level of authority over every team's code base. It just, it's there are obviously people who have organizational structure and with job responsibility, authority to work with those teams to do the right things. But individual teams own the code.
Yes, they review changes. Okay, like if that's the policy you want to run, fine. Then you don't have people with central commit flags, with global commit flags, right? That's not a thing in your organization. Fine. You can still use a monorepo to make these changes easy. Like, have your coordination, have your program technical program managers reach out and coordinate. But why stop there? One of the principles at Google is the principle of inner source, which is don't complain about problems, don't talk about problems, fix them, get busy, and spend all this time and energy you would about to talk about them to actually fix it. And again, fixing doesn't mean I've write into your code base against your will, and now I introduced a bunch of risks that you're not aware of. It means I make a pull request to your code base. You can review that. You can change that. And if I want you to approve my pull request, I have to reach out to you first. Not surprised about that. And then you're like, no, not going to happen. This is not coordinated. Obviously, I have to reach out to you first and say, here's what I'm planning. Yes, fine. Send me a pull request. I look at it. And then you merge it in. At this point, it is under your control, but I have made the actual act of doing this change easier rather than forcing 15,000 teams to do a refactor and go through this entire noodle through this entire process. I can just do it efficiently once and then
The noodle through that process is making use of APIs though to do that. And so that's, I think the key difference there is you use the API boundary as the contract between teams and the thing that allows you to go in. And that's the authority point where it's like, I need to make a change. I need you to make a change in your code because your code isn't doing what I need it to at the API boundary. That's the key. No one goes into anyone else's code base and says, I need to make this change because it makes your code more, more efficient or easier to test or better structured. Doesn't change the API, but it makes your code better. Trust me. Nobody does that. No one does that in somebody else's code base. It doesn't happen. That's a cultural anomaly that just doesn't happen. But changing the API, then you have the, in other words, if it's changing how outside of that service is impacted, even performance is part of the API, right? If it's making it faster, that's changing the API. That's a type of change to an API. It's a change to an SLA, which is part of the API. The SLA is a part of the API. That's still a change. And then you go through the process of requesting a change. And you can help with the change. There's nothing that prevents you from helping with the change, but you go through the team and you ask the team to make the change. They schedule the work on their schedule with their mechanisms using their structure because they own the code. They know their priorities. They know how it fits in. Yes, there can be management coordination between the two that says, no, we need to prioritize this differently for this business reason. All that still goes on too. But you don't make a change across the team's boundary without, without this API being the central part of the discussion.
Yeah, I think a philosophical difference is I see the team responsibility in reviewing code, and you see it as the team has to implement the change. I think that's one of
because in my model the team does everything. They have complete ownership, and the word complete is the critical part.
To me, ownership means having control over what goes into the code base, not as much that you have to yourself do everything in the code base.
So there's nothing in my model that says you can't accept input from other teams, and other teams can, if you want to, I mean, part of the negotiation for, I need this change to your code base can very well be, we don't have time to do it, but if you pony up a person to come in and do the work, that's great. That's part of the discussion too. That can be part of it. So there's nothing that prevents you from working in another team's code. But when you're working the other team's code, you're working for that team rather than working for your team. And then once you're done, then you come back and you do the changes you need to make on your side. When you're changing someone's code, you're working for them.
Yeah, so the open source model explicitly has a place for external contributions, right? If I have a code base open source, anybody in the world, they don't work for me. They don't have to answer to me. They can come and send me pull requests. For example, hey, I see that you use an outdated vulnerable dependency, or you use a deprecated language feature. Here is a change that fixes this. And I can now look at this, I can reject the pull request, or I can pull it in, right? I am in control. I'm the maintainer. I'm in control, but why can't other people propose changes to me? And the same is true in a mono repository. Upgrading a compiler is a good example. At Google, there's a central compiler team. They are in touch with all the vendors. They track alpha and beta versions of new compilers. They track the deprecations. They see the entire code base. They're really experts in understanding what it takes to upgrade the entire company to a new compiler version. They know what deprecations they will run into. They have bandwidth to build automation to often upgrade these things programmatically, programmatic code changes. I mean, these types of things like removing deprecations are great candidates for automated code changes, right? Like tool-based. And so this team does all that. And if they find a team where they have to make a change, they would reach out to that team and say, look, here's what's coming. In 2 weeks, we want to roll out this new version. We're going to send you, here's what we're going to change. And we're going to send you a pull request next week. Do we have bandwidth available to get this in? We don't want this to be open too long. We want to get this all done in a day. And then you can say yes or no. And then we can get this entire thing done quickly in a day rather than in a multi-repo. I would be concerned that now 10,000 different teams have to read up on the deprecation, have to like make somebody available or have to ramp up an external person on their code base. There's often like a learning curve involved there.
But you have to ramp up your code base anyway if you're going to have someone go in and touch your code base. There's got to be a wrap up there anyway. I mean, it's the amount, I would argue that the amount of, if you want someone to come in to make the change for you, the amount of effort it takes for that person to come into a poly repo and understand your code base enough to do the change is on par with the amount of work it would take for that person to do the same thing in a mono repo without coming up to speed in your code base and getting it right.
So you can automate both cases. In one case, I have to clone 10,000 repos and apply my tool there. In a mono repo, I can just apply my tool once. And I would say, yeah, sure, you can do it both, but a mono repo would make that much easier. And
that fits in the model of easier isn't necessarily good.
I mean, I can make it more economical, and at the same time, I can maintain all the independence and coordination that you bring up that I agree with that are important to keep this all under control. I can do all these things in a monorepo, but I can make the actual act of changing it economical.
Well, rarely the change itself is the risky part, right? It's the work around the change. It's the did this change affect anything? Did it break anything? Did it break the test that existed that we forgot to run? Did it break the test that we did run and it failed? Did it break the test that we should have written that we didn't have? Did it, you know, and that's where the hardest part of that's where most of the risk is in almost any changes in those areas, right? It's like, it's not the known knowns. It's the the known or the, even the known unknown. It's the unknown unknowns are the ones that become the hardest things to deal with availability outages. Rarely is an availability issue something that was like, yeah, well, we knew that was going to happen. You know, that's not typically the case. So, you know, the tool that just does it is doing the 10% of the job. They're not doing the 99% of the job. And the other 90% still has to happen. And arguably by making the 10% easier, you're encouraging that other 90% not to happen.
I don't know if I agree, both on the numbers and, for example, many things are like, listen, remove this deprecation, remove this deprecated API, switch to the new API. They might take the same data, they might in a different order or in a different way, but it's a relatively low critical change. Like a product manager or program manager would just say, yeah, sure, we'll do it. And then now somebody has to sit down and in each team and has to read up on it. And often the changes in each team are so small that it's not efficient for them to automate this. So they will just sit there and go through it manually and do a manual search and replace. But now you have 10,000 teams doing this. They all sit down manually because it's not worth for them to automate it, where it would be much easier to have one team write a programmatic solution for that, roll this all out, run all the tests and do it, and you can get it done. And so like in this hypothetical example, you would have spent one person day on getting this done versus spending many person months because you have hundreds or thousands of people each spending like half a day doing this, you know? And the reason why this is important is that many of these changes are important to keep a code base healthy over a long time. And if they are not economical, then they don't happen. And if you don't clean up code, then it degrades. And the human part is only part of it. Very often it's just legwork.
So I hear you. I hear what you're saying. I don't agree. Certainly in my experience, the riskiest part of any change is not the actual change, it's the impact of the change. And making something and the biggest impact and the most impact on availability often comes from the simplest changes. So making a change simple isn't in its own case a good thing. Making it appropriately simple and appropriately hard for the scale of the change is reasonable, because then that puts the proper level of expectations on how risky this change is. So just a general philosophy of we can do lots of things a lot simpler, cross the board, that argument doesn't fly with me, because that philosophically ignores the risk component. And that's I think and I completely agree, by the way, this is a philosophical discussion. And to the people listening to this, you won't go wrong as an organization using either model, or let me rephrase that. You will go wrong, but in different ways. I mean, obviously you're going to, you know, every way has its pros and cons, and you'll run into the cons of the approach you choose, but you also run into the pros. And I think maybe, you know, before we go on to the next topic, I think maybe a good way to kind of close out on this advantages, disadvantages approach is, it appears to me, and this might be something we can agree on, but it appears to me that which approach is right for your organization really truly depends on the culture of your organization. And, you know, the culture of an Amazon is very, 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 very fundamentally different than the culture of a Google, is very different than the culture of a Facebook, is very different than the culture of an Apple. And that the model that Google uses works very well for them, and the model that Apple uses works very well for them, and the model that Amazon works on works very well for them. There's nothing wrong with any of those approaches. And so the biggest advice I could give to someone listening to this who's trying to decide what to do is look at the culture of your company and or the culture you want to create if you're in the process of trying to create this. And that'll give you the clues for which model to use. But let's move off of advantages and disadvantages for now. I think I want to have one more other conversation, and that's specific about model repos. And that has to do with how do you scale model repos for these large organizations? I mean, so Git isn't the only repository engine out there, but it is the most popular. And I think most people who are listening to this know what Git is or and have used Git and probably use Git a lot if they use anything a lot. And that's fine, but you know, Git would not work for Google's code base, the size it is and the complexity is. I mean, stock standalone Git just wouldn't work. You can't have that much data. Git requires the entire data set to be downloaded to your laptop. That model just doesn't work with a mono repo of the size of Google. So the question I have is, if you decide to go the path of a mono repo, what tools are you aware of that make a large-scale mono repo scalable to be able to work the way that you want a mono repo to work? What tools would you recommend to people listening to look into?
Yes, you're right that Git is several orders of magnitude outclassed by Google's code base, where you have terabytes. Having said that, most companies in the world aren't Google. And Git, for example, already works pretty well for Microsoft. The Windows code base has 30 years of history, has millions of commits, and as far as I know, has 300 gigabytes of content. That's substantial.
That's not bad. Yeah. That's certainly manageable with Git.
Yes, and they had to jump to some hoops. They had to make some extensions to it, but they are working very actively on getting these extensions incorporated into the open source version of Git.
And so for most reasonable size companies, Git is scalable enough for a monorepo.
Yes, if you are the size of a Mozilla or a Microsoft, or the Linux kernel is an absolute no-brainer for Git. You experience no slowdowns. GitLab is another really large open source code base that is in a single monorepo, sizable, no problem. Like, you can run this with vanilla Git. Because it is so popular, because monorepos are becoming more and more popular in Silicon Valley, especially in the startup scene recently, and people are used to Git and kind of expect that to be the version control system to work with, there have been tremendous efforts to make it scalable. And so in the last couple of years, we have seen a number of improvements to Git, including sparse checkout, partial clones, shallow clones, that allow to run a partial, to only clone certain parts of Git on your local machine and then stream the rest from the remote, and even for multiple remotes for that matter. So I would,
the Dropbox model of file synchronization.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I would highly suggest anybody to look in Git, into Git. And if you, there are lots of knobs to twist there to make it scale to millions of files and many, many gigabytes of content. If you exceed that, you can look into the extensions that Microsoft is working on for Git. There are two that are noteworthy. One is VFS for Git, which is a virtual file system that streams content as needed from the central repo. The other is Scalar, which is a more vanilla Git approach where they just automate certain long-running operations in the background, like updating the running the garbage collector of Git. That's something that Git does interactively right now every so often, and in a large repo that can block your machine for half an hour. That's something that Scala would run in the background, so you don't bother by it. If that is not enough, some companies like Facebook and Google are working with Mercurial, which makes it easier to make it scalable. That's another option that some companies like Facebook, Mozilla, and Google are looking into. Google itself.
What is Google doing? Yeah. What is Google doing now?
Google has hopelessly outgrown all of these options, and they were forced to move into a fully custom development infrastructure. They have a custom version control system called Piper that pretty much streams everything from the cloud, and that also radically simplifies the whole version control model. Because in a monorepo, often you want to do trunk-based development because there's so many changes happening and refactoring is so efficient that it happens a lot. So there are a lot of changes even in your own code base that you don't want to have long running branches in a monorepo. They tend to result in a lot of merge conflicts. So you want to have short-lived feature branches and then merge them straight into head. And then the moment they get merged into the main code line, they are live for everybody. So Google has a much simplified branching model there, and that made it worthwhile for them to develop their own solution. The advantage is that your client is really small because everything gets streamed from the cloud. Your client really only consists of the files that you have changed. In addition to that, Google has built an entire array of additional tools that help them manage the monorepo. And it helped them do some of these things we spoke about earlier, like getting each individual team to review and approve large-scale sweeping changes. They have a tool called Rosie that cuts up a large pull request into many smaller pull requests, get them all reviewed individually, stitches them back together, and commits them atomically. Like, that's something that they certainly underestimated when they started on their monorepo journey. And
yeah, that's, we didn't talk about that, but that certainly is that would be highly valuable to make a monorepo. When you're talking about a commit that goes across, let's say 20 teams, you know, even six teams, right? Trying to get, you know, round six cats up to be going the same direction can be a hard thing to do. And the same thing is true with Git committers.
Yeah. It's still cheaper in a monorepo, but you need some extra tooling.
Well, on that note, no. So, you know, Kevin, this has been absolutely a wonderful conversation. I definitely appreciate this. I think I want to make sure to stress to everyone that both of these are good approaches. I obviously have strong opinions. You obviously have strong opinions. Obviously Google has strong opinions. Amazon, everyone has strong opinions on this. If you're trying to decide what to do, there's nothing wrong with either approach, but there, for your particular case, there might be one. And that, matter of fact, there is going to be one strategy that works significantly better than the other. And the other strategy will work, will be horrendous for you because you'll run into all sorts of cultural issues. It's an important, my point by saying that is, it's an important decision that you get right. Either decision, there's nothing wrong with either decision, but for your company, there's going to be a right and a wrong answer, and you need to figure out what that is. And look at the cultural aspects of your company. Look at your ownership models. Look at your collaboration strategies and techniques and what works and what doesn't work. And look at those things and try and figure out what you want to optimize and what you don't want to optimize. And from that, you'll figure out what the right answer is for your organization.
Another aspect to consider is just what you have so far and what you're used to. If you're running a poly repository right now and it works for you, why change it? And your people are all comfortable with it, and you have your entire DevOps tooling built around it, right? Why change it?
Absolutely. You're right. If you've got a model that works for you, there's no grass is greener here. You know, if it works for you, it works for you. And that probably means the other approach is going to be a pain in the neck for you. So keep with what works for you. Okay, I'd like to, you know, thank Kevin Gosseler. Thank you, Kevin, for joining me today. I very much appreciate your time and energy here. This has been a great conversation. I know we've had this conversation several times now on Slack and I want to say in person, but over video. And I very much appreciate this conversation. Thank you for coming on board today. And if you have any questions about this technique and want to talk to Kevin, I'm putting Kevin's Twitter and LinkedIn contact information in the show notes. So feel free to reach out to him and thank him also for his work on this. Kevin, thank you very much for your time, and I appreciate you coming on Modern Digital Applications.
Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed this.
Thank you for listening to Modern Digital Applications with Lee Acheson. Lee helps executives keep up with industry trends and best practices in cloud computing, application scaling, DevOps, and applications modernization. in order to stay in front of disruptive influencers. Subscribe to this podcast to ensure you get each new episode as it's available. Visit mdacast.com for all the resources and publications from Lee and his team. Thank you for tuning in to today's show.